Welcome to Protecting Project Pulp, part of the District of Wonders Network, featuring Starship Sofa, Tales to Terrify, and Crime City Central. Everyone has a story in the District of Wonders. Come and find yours.
This is Protecting Project Pulp, episode 83. I'm your host, Simon Hildebrandt. Welcome to the show. This week we bring you Elf Trap by Francis Stevens, narrated by Josh Roseman. Francis Stevens is the pseudonym of Gertrude Barrows Bennett, considered to be the first major female writer of fantasy and science fiction in the United States, and has been called the woman who invented dark fantasy. Born in Minneapolis in 1883, she completed school through the eighth grade and then attended night school in the hopes of becoming an illustrator. But financial pressures instead drove her into work as a stenographer, a job she held on and off for the rest of her life. Despite having a story accepted for publication by Argosy in 1904, when she was just 17, it wasn't until she began caring for her invalid mother in 1909 when she returned to writing in earnest. Over the next few years, Bennett wrote a number of science fiction and fantasy short stories and novellas, and even several novels, including The Citadel of Fear, The Heads of Cerberus, and Claimed. Bennett died in 1948, leaving a remarkable legacy. She is thought to have influenced both H.P. Lovecraft and A. Merritt, and was described by critic Sam Moskowitz as the greatest woman writer of science fiction in the period between Mary Wollstonecraft Shelley and C.L. Moore. Josh Roseman, not the trombonist, the other one, lives in Georgia, the state, not the country. His writing has appeared in Asimov's, Escape Pod, and the cross-genres anthology Fat Girl in a Strange Land. His fiction has been reprinted by the Doonstief audio fiction magazine and Starship Sofa, and his voice has been heard on two Escape Artists and all four District of Wonders podcasts. When not writing, he mostly complains about the fact that he's not writing. Find him online at roseplusman.com or on Twitter at listener42. He's narrated for us twice before for the stories Metaphory and Letter from the Stars. So who knows what fate awaits those that are caught. This is Elf Trap by Francis Stevens, narrated by Josh Roseman.
In this, our well-advertised modern world, crammed with engines, death-dealing shells, life-dealing serums, and science, he who listens to old wives' tales is counted idle. He who believes them, a superstitious fool. Yet there are some legends which have a strange, deathless habit of recrudescence in many languages and lands. Of one such I have a story to tell. It was related to me by a well-known specialist in nervous diseases, not as an instance of the possible truth behind fable, but as a curious case in which, I quote his words, the delusions of a diseased brain were reflected by a second and otherwise sound mentality. No doubt his view was the right one, and yet, at the finish, I had the strangest flash of feeling, as if somewhere, sometime, I, like young Wharton, had stood and seen against blue sky Elva of the sky-hued scarf and the yellow honeysuckles. But my part is neither to feel nor surmise. I will tell the story as I heard it, save for substitution of fictitious names for real ones. My quotations from the Red Notebook are verbatim. Theron Tatimus, AAS, FES, DS, etc., occupied the chair of biology in a not unfamed university. He was the author of a treatise on cytology, since widely used as a textbook, and of several important brochures on the more obscure infusoria. As a boy, he had been, in appearance, a romantically charming person. The age of 37 found him still handsome, in a cold, fine-drawn manner, but almost inhumanly detached from any save scientific interests. Then, at the height of his career, he died. Having entered his classroom with intent to deliver the first lecture of the fall term, he walked to his desk, laid down a small red notebook, turned, opened his mouth, went ghastly white, and subsided. His assistant, young Wharton, was first to reach him and first to discover the shocking truth. Tatimus was unmarried, and his will bequeathed all he possessed to the university. The little red book was not at first regarded as important. Supposed to contain notes for his lecture, it was laid aside. On being at last read, however, by his assistant in course of arranging his papers, the book was found to contain not notes, but a diary covering the summer just past. Barring the circumstances of one peculiar incident, Wharton already knew the main facts of that summer. Tadimus, at the insistence of his physician, the specialist aforesaid, had spent July and August in the Carolina Mountains, not far from the famous resort, Asheville. Dr. Locke was friend as well as medical advisor, and he lent his patient the use of a bungalow he owned there. It was situated in a beautiful but lonely spot, to which the nearest settlement was Carcassonne. In the valley below stood a tiny railroad station, but Carcassonne was not built up around this, nor was it a town at all in the ordinary sense. A certain landscape painter had once raised him a house on that mountainside, at a place chosen for its magnificent view. Later, he was wont to invite thither for summer sketching one or two of his more favored pupils. Later still, he increased this number. For their accommodation, other structures were raised near his mountain studio, and the Blue Ridge summer class became an established fact, with a name of its own and a rather large membership. Two roads led thither from the valley. One, that most in use by the artist colonists, was as good and broad as any Carolina mountain road could hope to be. The other, a winding, narrow yellow track, passed the lonely bungalow of Dr. Locke, and at last split into two paths, one of which led on to further heights, the second to Carcassonne. The distance between colony and bungalow was considerable, and neither was visible to the other. Tadimus was not interested in art, and, as disclosed by the Red Book, he was not even aware of Carcassonne's existence until some days after his arrival at the bungalow. Solitude, long walks, deep breathing, and abstinence from work or sustained thought had been Dr. Locke's prescription, accepted with seeming meekness by Tadimus. Nevertheless, but a short time passed till Wharton received a telegram from the professor ordering him to pack and send by express certain apparatus, including a microscope and dissecting stand. The assistant obeyed. Another fortnight, and Dr. Locke in turn received an urgent wire. It was from Jake Higgins, the Negro caretaker whom he had lent to Tadimus along with the bungalow. Leaving his practice to another man's care, Dr. Locke fled for the Carolina Blue Ridge. He found his caretaker and his bungalow, but no Tadimus. By Jake's story, the professor had gone to walk one afternoon and had not returned. Having wired Locke, the caretaker had otherwise done his best. He notified the county sheriff, and search parties scoured the mountains. At his appeal, too, the entire Carcassonian colony, male and female, turned out with enthusiasm to hunt for Tadimus. Many of them carried easel and sketchbox along, and for such it is to be feared that their humane search ended with the discovery of any tempting tit in the scenic line. However, the colony's efforts were at least as successful as the sheriff's, or indeed those of anyone else. Shortly before Tadimus's vanishment, a band of gypsies had settled themselves in a group of old, empty, half-ruined shacks about a mile from Locke's bungalow. Suspicion fell upon them. A posse visited the encampment, searched it, and questioned every member of the migrant band. They were a particularly ill-favored set, dirty and villainous of feature. Nothing, however, could be found of either the missing professor or anything belonging to him. The posse left, after a quarrel that came near to actual fighting. A dog, a wretched starved yellow cur, had attacked one of the deputies and set its teeth in his boot. He promptly shot it. In their resentment, the dog owners drew knives. The posse were more efficiently armed, and, under threat of the latter's rifles and shotguns, the gypsies reconsidered. They were warned to pack up and leave, and following a few days' delay, they obeyed the mandate. On the very morning of their departure, which was also the eighth day after Tadimus's disappearance, Dr. Locke sat down gloomily to breakfast. The search, he thought, must be further extended. Let it cover the whole Blue Ridge if need be. Somewhere in those mountains was a friend and patient whom he did not propose to lose. At one side of the breakfast room was a door. It led into the cleared-out bedroom which Locke had, with indignation, discovered to have been converted into a laboratory by the patient he had sent here to rest. Suddenly, this door opened. Out walked Theron Tadimus. He seemed greatly amazed to find Locke there, and said that he had come in shortly after midnight, and been in his laboratory ever since. Questioned as to his whereabouts before that, he replied surprisingly that throughout the week he had been visiting with friends in Carcassonne. Dr. Locke doubted his statement, and reasonably. Artists are not necessarily liars, and every artist and near artist in the Carcassonne colony had not only denied knowledge of the professor, but spent a good part of the week helping hunt for him. Later, after insisting that Locke accompany him to Carcassonne and meet his friends there, Tatimus suddenly admitted that he had not previously been near the place. He declined, however, either to explain his untruthful first statement or give any other account of his mysterious absence. 1 week ago, Tatimus had left the bungalow, carrying nothing but a light cane and wearing a white flannel suit, canvas shoes, and a panama. That was his idea of a tramping costume. He had returned, dressed in the same suit, hat, and shoes. Moreover, though white, they looked neat as when he started, save for a few grass stains and the road's inevitable yellow clay about his shoe soles. If he had spent the week vagrant-wise, he had been remarkably successful in keeping his clothes clean. Asheville, thought the doctor. He went by train, stopped at a hotel, and has returned without the faintest memory of his real doings. Lame, overtaxed nerves can play that sort of trick with a man's brain. But he kept the opinion to himself. Like a good doctor, he soon dropped the whole subject, particularly because he saw that Tatimus was deeply distressed and trying to conceal the fact. On plea of taking a long-delayed vacation of his own, Locke remained some time at the bungalow, guarded his friend from the curiosity of those who had combed the hills for him, and did all in his power to restore him to health and a clear brain. He was so far successful that Tatimus returned to his classes in the fall, with Locke's consent, to his classes, and death. Wharton had known all this. He knew that Tatimus's whereabouts during that mysterious week had never been learned, but the diary in the Red Book purported to cover the summer, including that week. To Wharton, the record seemed so supremely curious that he took a liberty with what was now the university's property. He carried the book to Dr. Locke. It was evening, and the latter was about to retire after a day's work that began before dawn. "Personal, you say?" Locke handled the book, frowning slightly. "Personal, but I feel, when you finish reading that, I have a rather queer thing to tell you in addition. You can't understand till you've read it. I am almost sure that what is described here has a secret bearing on Professor Tatimus's death." His heart failed. Overwork. There was no mystery in that. "Maybe not, Doctor. And yet, won't you please read?" "Run through it aloud for me," said the doctor. "I couldn't read one of my own prescriptions tonight, and you are more familiar with that microscopic writing of his." Wharton complied. Monday, July 3rd. Arrived yesterday. Not worse than expected, but bad enough. If Locke were here, he should be satisfied. I have absolutely no occupation. Walked and climbed for 2 hours, as prescribed. Spent the rest of day pacing up and down indoors. Enough walking, at least. I can't sit idle. I can't stop thinking. Locke is a fool. Thursday, July 6th. Telegraphed Wharton today. He will express me the swift binocular, some slides, cover glasses, and a very little other apparatus. Locke is a fool. I shall follow his advice, but within reason. There is a room here, lighted by 5 windows. Old Jake has cleared the bedroom furniture out. It has qualities as a laboratory. Not, of course, that I intend doing any real work. An hour or so a day of micrological observation will only make resting tolerable. Tuesday, July 11th. Jake hitched up his old gray mule and has brought my 3 cases from the station. I unpacked the old Stevenson Swift and set it up. The mere touch of it brought tears to my eyes. Locke's rest cure has done that to my nerves. After unpacking, though, I resolutely let the microscope and other things be. Walked 10 miles up hill and down, tried to admire the landscape as Locke advised, but can't see much in it. Rocks, trees, lumpy hills, yellow roads, sky, clouds, buzzards. Beauty? What beauty is there in this vast, clumsy world that is the outer husk for nature's real and delicate triumphs? I saw a man painting today. He was swabbing at a canvas with huge, clumsy brushes. He had his easel set up by the road, and I stopped to see what any human being could find hereabout worth picturing. And what had this painter, this artist, this lover of beauty chosen for a subject? Why, about a mile from here there is a clump of ugly, dark trees. A stream runs between them and the road. It is yellow with clay, and too swift. The more interesting microorganisms could not exist in it. A ramshackle plank bridge crosses it, leading to the grove, and there, between the trees, stand and lean some dreary half-ruined huts. That scene was the one which my artist had chosen for his subject. For sheer curiosity, I got into conversation with the fellow. Unusual gibberish of chiaroscuro, flat tones, masses, etc., not a definite thought in his head as to why he wished to paint those shacks. I learned one thing, though. He wasn't the isolated specimen of his kind I had thought him. Locke failed to tell me about Carcassonne. Think of it, nearly 100 of these insane pursuers of beauty are spending the summer within walking distance of the house I have promised to live in. And the one who was painting the grove actually invited me to call on him. I smiled noncommittally and came home. On the way, I passed the branch road that leads to the place. I had always avoided that road, but I didn't know why until today. Imagine it, nearly 100, some of them women, I suppose. No, I shall keep discreetly away from Carcassonne. Saturday, July 15th. Jake informs me that a band of gypsies have settled themselves in the grove which my Carcassonian acquaintance chose to paint. They are living in the ruined huts. Now I shall avoid that road, too. Talk of solitude! Why, the hills are fairly swarming with artists, gypsies, and Lord knows who else. One might as well try to rest in a beehive. Found some interesting variations of the ciliara living in a nearby pond. Wonderful! Have recorded over 12 specimens in which the macronucleus is unquestionably double. Not lobed, not pulverate, as in Oxytricha, but double! My summer has not, after all, been wasted. Felt singularly slack and tired this morning, and realized that I have hardly been out of the house in 3 days. Shall certainly take a long tramp tomorrow. Monday, July 17th. Absent-mindedness betrayed me today. I had a very unpleasant experience. Resolutely keeping my promise to Locke, I sallied forth this afternoon and walked briskly for some distance. I had, however, forgotten the gypsies, and took my old route. Soon I met a woman, or rather a girl. She was arrayed in the tattered, brilliantly colored garments which women of these wandering tribes affect. There was a scarf about her head. I noticed, because its blue was exactly the same brilliant hue of the sky over the mountains behind her. There was a stripe of yellow in it, too, and thrust in her sash she carried a great bunch of yellow flowers. Wild honeysuckle, I think. Her face was not dark, like the swart faces of most gypsies. On the contrary, the skin of it had a smooth, firm whiteness. Her features were fine and delicate. Passing, we looked at one another, and I saw her eyes brighten in the strangest, most beautiful manner. I am sure that there was nothing bold or immodest in her glance. It was rather like the look of a person who recognizes an old acquaintance and is glad of it. Yet we never met before. Had we met, I could not have forgotten her. We passed without speaking, of course, and I walked on. Meeting the girl, I had hardly thought of her as a gypsy, or indeed tried to classify her in any way. The impression she left was new in my experience. It was only on reaching the grove that I came to myself, as it were, and remembered Jake's story of the gypsies who were camping there. Then I very quickly emerged from the vague, absurd happiness which sight of the girl had brought. While talking with my Carcassonian, I had observed that grove rather carefully. I had thought it perfect, that nothing added could increase the somber ugliness of its trees, nor the desolation of its gray, ruined, tumble-down old huts. Today, I learned better. To be perfect, ugliness must include sordid humanity. The shacks, dreary in themselves, were hideous now. In their doorways lounged fat, unclean women, nursing their filthy offspring. Older children, clothed in rags, caked with dirt, sprawled and fought among themselves. Their voices were the snarls of animals. I realized that the girl with the sky-like scarf had come from here, out of this filth unspeakable. A yellow cur, the mere starved skeleton of a dog, came tearing down to the bridge. A rusty, jangling bell was tied about its neck with a string. The beast stopped on the far side and crouched there, yapping. Its anger seemed to surpass mere canine savagery. The lean jaws fairly writhed in maniacal but loathsomely feeble ferocity. A few men, whiskered, dirty-faced, were gathered about a sort of forge erected in the grove. They were making something, beating it with hammers in the midst of showers of sparks. As the dog yapped, one of the men turned and saw me. He spoke to his mates, and to my dismay they stopped work and transferred their attention to me. I was afraid that they would cross the bridge, and the idea of having to talk to them was for some reason inexpressibly revolting. They stayed where they were, but one of them suddenly laughed out loudly and held up to my view the thing upon which they had been hammering. It was a great, clumsy, rough iron trap. Even at that distance I could see the huge, jagged teeth fit to maim a bear or a man. It was the ugliest instrument I have ever seen. I turned away and began walking toward home, and when I looked back they were at work again. The sun shone brightly, but about the grove there seemed to be a queer darkness. It was like a place alone and aloof from the world. The trees even were different from the other mountain trees. Their heavy branches did not stir at all in the wind. They had a strange, dark, flat look against the sky, as though they had been cut from dark paper, or rather, like the flat trees woven in a tapestry. That was it. The whole scene was like a flat, dark, unreal picture in tapestry. I came straight home. My nerves are undoubtedly in bad shape, and I think I shall write Locke and ask him to prescribe medicine that will straighten me up. So far, his rest cure has not been notably successful. Wednesday, July 19th. I have met her again. Last night, I could not sleep at all. Round midnight, I ceased trying, rose, dressed, and spent the rest of the night with the good old Stevenson Swift. My light for night work, a common oil lamp, is not very brilliant. This morning I suffered considerable pain behind the eyes, and, determined to give Locke's walking in open air treatment another trial, though discouraged by previous results. This time I remembered to turn my back on the road which leads to that hideous grove. The sunlight seemed to increase the pain I was already suffering. The air was hot, full of dust, and I had to walk slowly. At the slightest increase of pace, my heart would set up a kind of fluttering, very unpleasant, and giving me a sense of suffocation. Then I came to the girl. She was seated on a rock, her lap heaped with wild honeysuckle, and she was weaving the flower stems together. Seeing me, she smiled. "I have your garland finished," she said, "and mine soon will be." One would have thought the rock a trysting place at which we had for a long time been accustomed to meet. In her hand she was extending to me a wreath made of the honeysuckle flowers. I can't imagine what made me act as I did. Weariness and the pain behind my eyes may have robbed me of my usual good sense. Anyway, rather to my own surprise, I took her absurd wreath and sat down where she made room for me on the boulder. After that, we talked. At this moment, only a few hours later, I couldn't say whether or not the girl's English was correct, nor exactly what she said, but I can remember the very sound of her voice. I recall, too, that she told me her name Elva, and that when I asked for the rest of it, she informed me that one good name was enough for one good person. That struck me as a charmingly humorous sally. I laughed like a boy, or a fool, God knows which. Soon she had finished her second garland, and laughingly insisted that we each crown the other with flowers. Imagine it. Had one of my students come by then, I am sure he would have been greatly startled. Professor Theron Tatamus, seated on a rock with a gypsy girl, crowned with wild honeysuckle, and adjusting a similar wreath to the girl's blue-scarfed head. Luckily, neither the student nor anyone else passed, and in a few minutes she said something that brought me to my senses. Due to that inexplicable dimness of memory, I quote the sense, not her words. "My father is a ruler among our people. You must visit us. For my sake, the people and my father will make you welcome." She spoke with the gracious air of a princess, but I rose hastily from beside her. A vision of the grove had returned, dark, oppressive, like an old dark tapestry woven with the ugly forms and foliage. I remembered the horrible, filthy tribe from which this girl had sprung. Without a word of farewell, I left her there on the rock. I did not look back, nor did she call after me. Not until reaching home, when I met old Jake at the door and saw him stare, did I remember the honeysuckle wreath. I was still wearing it, and carrying my hat. Snatching at the flowers, I flung them in the ditch and retreated with what dignity I might into the bungalow's seclusion. It is night now, and, a little while since, I went out again. The wreath is here in the room with me. The flowers were unsoiled by the ditch, and seem fresh as when she gave them to me. They are more fragrant than I had thought even wild honeysuckle could be. Elva, Elva of the sky-blue scarf and the yellow honeysuckle. My eyes are heavy, but the pain behind them is gone. I think I shall sleep tonight. Friday, July 21st. Is there any man so gullible as he who prides himself on his accuracy of observation? I ask this in humility, for I am that man. Yesterday, I rose, feeling fresher than for weeks past. After all, Locke's treatment seemed worthy of respect. With that in mind, I put in only a few hours staining some of my binucleate cilia and finishing the slides. All the last part of the afternoon, I faithfully tramped the roads. There is undoubtedly a sort of broad, coarse charm in mere landscape with its reaches of green, its distant purples, and the sky like a blue scarf flung over it all. Had the pain of my eyes not returned, I could almost have enjoyed those vistas. Having walked farther than usual, it was deep dusk when I reached home. As if from ambush, a little figure dashed out from behind some rhododendrons. It seemed to be a child, a boy, though I couldn't see him clearly, nor how he was dressed. He thrust something into my hand. To my astonishment, the thing was a spray of wild honeysuckle. "Elva! Elva! Elva!" The strange youngster was fairly dancing up and down before me, repeating the girl's name and nothing else. Recovering myself, I surmised that Elva must have sent this boy, and sure enough, at my insistence, he managed to stop prancing long enough to deliver her message. Elva's grandmother, he said, was very ill. She had been ailing for days, but tonight the sickness was worse, much worse. Elva feared that her grandmother would die and, "Of course," the boy said, "no doctor will come for our sending." She had remembered me as the only friend she knew among the outside people. Wouldn't I come and look at her poor sick grandmother? And if I had any of the outside people's medicine in my house, would I please bring that with me? Well, yes, I did hesitate. Aside from practical and obvious suspicions, I was possessed with a senseless horror for not only the gypsy tribe, but the grove itself. But there was the spray of honeysuckle. In her need, she had sent that for a token and sent it to me. Elva of the sky-like scarf and laughing mouth. "Wait here," I said to the boy, rather brusquely, and entered the house. I had remembered a pocket case of simple remedies, none of which I had ever used, but there was a direction pamphlet with them. If I must play amateur physician, that might help. I looked for Jake, meaning to inform him of my proposed expedition. Though he had left a chicken broiling on the kitchen range, he was not about. He might have gone to the spring for water. Passing out again, I called the boy, but received no answer. It was very dark. Toward sunset, the sky had clouded over, so that now I had not even the benefit of starlight. I was angry with the boy for not waiting, but the road was familiar enough, even in the dark. At least, I thought it was, till colliding with a clump of holly, I realized that I must have strayed off and across a bare stretch of yellow clay which defaces the mountainside above Locke's bungalow. I looked back for the guiding lights of its windows, but the trees hid them. However, the road couldn't be far off. After some stumbling about, I was sure that my feet were in the right track again. Somewhat later, I perceived a faint ruddy point of light to the left and ahead of me. As I walked toward it, the rapid rush and gurgle of water soon apprised me that I had reached the stream with the plank bridge across it. There I stood for several minutes, staring toward the ruddy light. That was all I could see. It seemed somehow to cast no illumination about it. There came a scamper of paws, the tinkle of a bell, and then a wild yapping broke out on the stream's far side. That vile, yellow cur, I thought. Elva, having imposed on my kindness to the extent of sending for me, might at least have arranged a better welcome than this. When I pictured her,
crouched in her bright, summer-colored garments, tending the dreadful old hag that her grandmother must be. The rest of the tribe were probably indifferent. She could not desert her sick, and there stood I, hesitant as any other coward. For the dog's sake, I took a firm grip on my cane. Feeling about with it, I found the bridge and crossed over. Instantly, something flung itself against my legs and was gone before I could hit out. I heard the dog leaping and barking all around me. It suddenly struck me that the beast's voice was not like that of the yellow cur. There was nothing savage in it. This was the cheerful, well-excited bark of a well-bred dog that welcomes its master, or its master's friend. And the bell that tinkled to every leap had a sweet, silvery note, different from the cracked jangle of the cur's bell. I had hated and loathed that yellow brute, and to think that I need not combat the creature was a relief. The huts, as I recalled them, weren't 50 yards beyond the stream. There was no sign of a campfire, just that one ruddy point of light. I advanced.
Wharton paused suddenly in his reading. "Here," he interpolated, "begins that part of the diary which passed from commonplace to amazing. And the queer part is that in writing it, Professor Tatimus seems to have been unaware that he was describing anything but an unusually pleasant experience." Dr. Locke's heavy brows knit in a frown. "Pleasant," he snapped. "The date of that entry?" "July 21. The day he disappeared. I see. Pleasant. And that gypsy girl. Huh. What an adventure for such a man. No wonder he tried to lie out of it. I don't think I care to hear the rest, Wharton. Whatever it is, my friend is dead. Let him rest."
"Oh, but wait," cried the young man with startled earnestness. "Good Lord, Doctor, do you believe I would bring this book even to you if it contained that kind of story about Professor Tatimus? No, its amazing quality is along different lines than you can possibly suspect."
"Get on with it, then," grumbled Locke. And Wharton continued. Suddenly, as though at a signal, not one, but a myriad of lights blazed into existence. It was like walking out of a dark closet into broad day. The first dazzlement passing, I perceived that instead of the somber grove and ruined huts, I was facing a group of very beautiful houses. It is curious how a previous and false assumption will rule a man. Having believed myself at the gypsy encampment, several minutes passed before I could overcome my bewilderment and realize that after losing my road, I had not actually regained it, that I had somehow wandered into the other branch road and reached, not the grove, but Carcassonne. I had no idea either that this artist's colony could be such a really beautiful place. It is cut by no streets. The houses are set here and there over the surface of such green lawns as I have never seen in these mountains of rock and yellow clay. Dr. Locke started slightly in his chair. Carcassonne, as he had himself seen it, flashed before his memory. He did not interrupt, but from that moment his attention was alertly set, like a man who listens for the key word of a riddle.
Everywhere there were lights, hung in the flowering branches of trees, glowing upward from the grass, blazing from every door and window. Why they should have been turned on so abruptly after that first darkness, I do not yet know. Out of the nearest house, a girl came walking. She was dressed charmingly in thin, bright-colored silks. A bunch of wild honeysuckle was thrust in the girdle, and over her hair was flung a scarf of sky-like blue. I knew her instantly, and began to see a glimmering of the joke that had been played on me. The dog bounded toward the girl. He was a magnificent collie. A tiny silver bell was attached to his neck by a broad ribbon. I take credit for considerable aplomb in my immediate behavior. The girl had stopped a little way off. She was laughing, but I had certainly allowed myself to be victimized. On my accusation, she at once admitted to having deceived me. She explained that, perceiving me to be misled by her appearance into thinking her one of the gypsies, she could not resist carrying out the joke. She had sent her small brother with the token and the message. I replied that the boy deserted me, and that I had nearly invaded the camp of real gypsies while looking for her and the fictitious dying grandmother. At this, she appeared even more greatly amused. Elva's mirth has a particularly contagious quality. Instead of being angry, I found myself laughing with her. By this time, quite a throng of people had emerged on the lawns and leading me to a dignified, fine-looking old man who she said was her father. She presented me. In the moment, I hardly noticed that she used my first name only, Theron, which I had told her when we sat on the roadside boulder. I have observed since that all these people use the single name only in presentation and intercourse. Though lacking personal experience with artists, I have heard that they are inclined to peculiar fads of unconventionality. I had never, however, imagined that they could be attractive to a man like myself, or pleasant to know. I am enlightened. These Carcassonian colonists are the only charming, altogether delightful people whom I have ever met. One and all, they seemed acquainted with Elva's amusing jest at my expense. They laughed with us, but in recompense have made me one of themselves in the pleasantest manner. I dined in the house of Elva's father. The dining room, or rather hall, is a wonderful place. Due to much microscopic work, I am inclined to see only clumsiness, largeness, in what other people characterize as beauty. Carcassonne is different. There is a minute perfection about the architecture of these artists' houses, the texture of their clothes, and even the delicate contour of their faces, which I find amazingly agreeable. There is no conventionality of costume among them. Both men and women dress as they please, their individual taste is exquisite, and the result is an array of soft fabrics and bright colors, flower-like rather than garish. Till last night, I had never learned the charm of what is called fancy dress, nor the genial effect it may exert on even a rather somber nature, such as I admit mine to be. Elva, full of good-natured mischief, insisted that I must dress for dinner. Her demand was instantly backed by the whole laughing throng. Carried off my feet in a way to which I am not at all used, I let them drape me in white robes, laced with silver embroideries like the delicate crystallization of hoarfrost. Dragged hilariously before a mirror, I was amazed at the change in my appearance. Unlike the black, scarlet-hooded gown of my university, these glittering robes lent me not dignity, but a kind of, I can only call it a noble youthfulness. I looked younger, and at the same time keener, more alive, and either the contagious spirit of my companions or some resurgence of boyishness filled me with a sudden desire to please, to be merry with the merrymakers, and, I must be frank, particularly to keep Elva's attention where it seemed temporarily fixed, on myself. My success was unexpectedly brilliant. There is something in the very atmosphere of Carcassonne which, once yielded to, exhilarates like wine. I have never danced, nor desired to learn. Last night, after a banquet so perfect that I hardly recall its details, I danced. I danced with Elva, and with Elva, and always with Elva. She laughed aside all other partners. We danced on no polished floors, but out on the green lawns under white, laughing stars. Our music was not orchestral. Wherever the light-footed couples chose to circle, there followed a young flutist, piping on his flute of white ivory. Fluttering wings, driving clouds, wind-tossed leaves, all the light, swift things of the air were in that music. It lifted and carried one with it. One did not need to learn. One danced. It seems as I write that the flute's piping is still in my ears, and that its echoes will never cease. Elva's voice is like the ivory flutels. Last night I was mad with the music and her voice. We danced, I know not how long, nor when we ceased. This morning, I awakened in a gold and ivory room with round windows that were full of blue sky and crossed by blossoming branches. Dimly, I recalled that Elva's father had urged me to accept his hospitality for the night. Too much of such new happiness may have gone to my head, I'm afraid. At least it was nothing stronger. At dinner, I drank only one glass of wine, sparkling, golden stuff, but mild, and with a taste like the fragrance of Elva's wild honeysuckle blooms. It is mid-morning now, and I am writing this, seated on a marble bench beside a pool in the central court of my host's house. I am waiting for Elva, who excused herself to attend to some duty or other. I found this book in my pocket, and thought best to make an immediate record of not only a good joke on myself, but the only really pleasant social experience I have ever enjoyed. I must lay aside these fanciful white robes, bid Elva goodbye, and return to my lonely bungalow. And Jake. The poor old man is probably tearing his hair out over my unexplained absence. But I hope for another invitation to Carcassonne. Saturday, July 22nd. I seem to be staying on indefinitely. This won't do. I spoke to Elva of my extended visit, and she laughingly informed me that people who have drunk the wine and worn the woven robes of Carcassonne seldom wish to leave. She suggested that I give up trying to escape and spend my life here. Jest, of course, but I half wished her words were earnest. She and her people are spoiling me for the common workaday world. Not that they are idle, but their occupations, as well as pleasures, are of a delicate, fascinating beauty. Whole families are stopping here, including the children. I don't care for children as a rule, but these are harmless as butterflies. I met Elva's messenger, her brother. He is a funny, dear little elf. How, even in the dark, I fancied him one of those gypsy brats is hard to conceive. But then I took Elva herself for a gypsy. My new friends engage in many pursuits besides painting. Crafts, I believe they are called. This morning, Elva took me around the shops, shops like architectural blossoms carved out of the finest marble. They make jewelry, weave fabrics, tool leather, and follow many other interesting occupations. Set in the midst of the lawns is a forge. Every part of it, even to the iron anvil, is embellished with a fern-like inlay of other metals. Several amateur silversmiths were at work there, but Elva hurried me away before I could see what they were about. I have inquired for the young painter who first told me of Carcassonne and invited me to visit him there. I can't recall his name, but on describing him to Elva, she replied vaguely that not every outsider was permanently welcome among her people. I didn't press the question. Remembering the ugliness which that same painter had been committing to canvas, I could understand that his welcome among these exquisite workers might be short-lived. He was probably banished, or banished himself, soon after our interview on the road. I must be careful, lest I wear out my own welcome. Yet the very thought of that old rough husk of a world that I must return to brings back the sickness and the pain behind my eyes that I had almost forgotten. Sunday, July 23rd. Elva. Her presence alone is delight. The sky is not bluer than her scarf and eyes. Sunlight is a duller gold than the wild honeysuckle she weaves in garlands for our heads. Today, like child sweethearts, we carved our names in the smooth trunk of a tree. Elva, Theron, and a wreath to shut them in. I am happy. Why? Why indeed should I leave Carcassonne? Monday, July 24th. Still here, but this is the last night that I shall impose upon these regally hospitable people. An incident occurred today, pathetic from one viewpoint, outrageous from another. I was asleep when it happened, and only woke up at the sound of the gunshot. Some rough young mountaineers rode into Carcassonne and wantonly killed Elva's collie dog. They claimed, I believe, that the unlucky animal attacked one of their number. A lie! The dog was gentle as a kitten. He probably leaped and barked around their horses and annoyed the young brutes. They had ridden off before I reached the scene. Elva was crying, and no wonder. They had blown her pet's head clean off with a shotgun. Don't know what will be done about it. I wanted to go straight to the county sheriff, but Elva wouldn't have that. I pretended to give in. But if her father doesn't see to the punishment of those men, I will. Murderous devils, Elva is too forgiving. Wednesday, July 26th. I watched the silversmiths today. Elva was not with me. I had no idea that silver was worked like iron. They must use some peculiar amalgam, or it would melt in the furnace instead of emerging, white hot, to be beaten with tiny, delicate hammers. They were making a strange-looking contraption. It was all silver, beaten into floral patterns, but the general shape was a riddle to me. Finally, I asked one of the smiths what they were about. He is a tall fellow with a merry, dark face. Guess, he demanded. Can't. To my ignorance, it resembles a Chinese puzzle. something more curious than that.
What?
An elf trap. He laughed mischievously.
Please.
Well, it's a trap anyway. See this? The others had stepped back good-naturedly.
With his hammer, he pressed on a lever.
Instantly, two slender, jaw-like parts of the queer machine opened wide. They were set with needle-like points, or teeth. It was all red-hot, and when he removed his hammer, the jaws clashed in a shower of sparks.
It's a trap, of course. I was still puzzled.
Yes, and a very remarkable one. This trap will not only catch, but it will re-catch.
I don't understand.
If any creature, man, say,
he was laughing again,
walks into this trap, he may escape it. But sooner or later, soon I should think, it will catch him again. That is why we call it an elf trap.
I perceived suddenly that he was making pure game of me. His mates were all laughing at the nonsense. I moved off, not offended, but perturbed in another way. He and his absurd silver trap toy had reminded me of the gypsies. What a horrible rough iron thing that was which they had held up to me from their forge. Men capable of creating such an uncouthly cruel instrument as that jag-toothed trap would be terrible to meet in the night. And I had come near to blundering in among them. At night! This won't do. I have been happy. Don't let me drop back into the morbidly nervous condition which invested those gypsies with more than human horror. Elva is calling me. I have been too long alone. Friday, July 28th. Home again. I am writing this in my bungalow laboratory. Gray dawn is breaking, and I have been at work here since midnight. Feel strangely depressed. Need breakfast, probably. Last night, Elva and I were together in the court of her father's house. The pool in the center of it is lighted from below to a golden glow. We were watching the goldfish with their wide, filmy tails of living lace. Suddenly, I gave a sharp cry. I had seen a thing in the water more important than goldfish. Snatching out the small collecting bottle, without which I never go abroad, I made a quick pass at the pool's glowing surface. Elva had started back, rather frightened. What is it?
I held the bottle up and peered closely. There was no mistake. Dysteria, I said triumphantly. Dysteria ciliata. Dysterlus giganticus, to give a unique specimen the separate name he deserves. Why, Elva, this enormous creature will give me a new insight on his entire species.
What enormous creature?
For the first time I saw Elva nearly petulant, but I was filled with enthusiasm. I let her look in the bottle.
There, I ejaculated. See him?
Where? I can't see anything but water and a tiny speck in it. That, I explained proudly, is Dysterius giganticus, large enough to be seen by the naked eye. Why, child, he's a monster of his kind, a freshwater variety, too. I thrust the bottle in my pocket.
Where are you going?
Home, of course. I can't get this fellow under the microscope any too quickly. I had forgotten how wide apart are the scientific and artistic temperaments. No explanation I could make would persuade Elva that my remarkable capture was worth walking a mile to examine properly.
You are all alike, she cried. All, you talk of love, but your love is for gold, or freedom, or some pitiful, foolish nothingness, like that speck of life you call by a long name, and leave me for.
But, I protested, only for a little while, I shall come back. She shook her head. This was Elva in a new mood, dark brows drawn, laughing mouth drooped to a sullen curve. I felt sorry to leave her angry, but my visit had already been preposterously long. Besides, a rush of desire had swept me to get back to my natural surroundings. I wanted the feel of the micrometer adjuster in my fingers, and to see the round, speckled white field under the lens pass from blurred chaos to perfect definition. She let me go at last. I promised solemnly to come to her whenever she should send or call. Foolish child, why, I can walk over to Carcassonne every day if she likes. I hear Jake rattling about in the breakfast room.
Conscience informs me that I have treated him rather badly. Wonder where he thought I was. Couldn't have been much worried, or he would have hunted me up in Carcassonne. August 30th. I shall not make any further entries in this book. My day for the making of records is over, I think. Any sort of records. I go back to my classes next month. God knows what I shall say to them. Elva. I may as well finish the story here. Every day, I find it harder to recall the details. If I hadn't this book, with what I wrote in it when I was there, I should believe that my brain had failed in earnest. Locke said I couldn't have been in Carcassonne. He stood in the breakfast room with the sunlight striking across him. I saw him, clearly. I saw the huge, coarse, ugly creature that he was, and in that minute, I knew. But I wouldn't admit it, even to myself. I made him go with me to Carcassonne. There was no stream. There was no bridge. The houses were wretched bungalows, set about on the bare, flat, yellow clay of the mountainside. The people, artists save the mark, were a common, carelessly dressed, painting-aproned crowd who fulfilled my original idea of an artist's colony. Their coarse features and thick skins sickened me. Locke walked home beside me, very silent. I could hardly bear his company. He was gross, coarse, human. Toward evening, managing to escape his company, I stole up the road to the gypsy's grove. The huts were empty. That queer look, as of a flat, dark tapestry, was gone from the grove. I crossed the plank bridge. Among the trees I found ashes, and a depression where the forge had stood. Something else, too. A dog, or rather its unburied remains. The yellow cur. Its head had been blown off by a shotgun. An ugly little bell lay in the mess, tied to a piece of string. One of the trees, it had a smooth trunk, and carved in the bark. I can't write it. I went away and left those two names carved there. The wild honeysuckle has almost ceased to bloom. I can leave now. Locke says I am well, and that I can return to my classes. I have not entered my laboratory since that morning. Locke admires my willpower for dropping all that till physical health should have returned. Willpower. I shall never, as long as I live, look into a microscope again. Perhaps she will know that somehow, and send or call for me quickly. I have drunk the wine and worn the woven robes of her people. They made me one of them. Is it right that they should cast me out because I did not understand what I have since guessed the meaning of so well? I can't bear the human folk about me. They are clumsy, revolting, and I can't work. God only knows what I shall say to my classes. Here is the end of my last record. Till she calls.
There was silence in Locke's private study. At last, the doctor expelled his breath in a long sigh. He might have been holding it all the time. Great heavens, he ejaculated. Poor old Tatimus. And I thought his trouble in the summer there was a temporary lapse. But he talked like a sane man, acted like one too, by Jove. With his mind in that condition, and in spite of the posse, he must have been with the gypsies all that week. You can see it. Even through his delusions, you catch occasional notes of reality. I heard of that dog shooting, and he speaks of being asleep when it happened. Where was he concealed that the posse didn't find him? Drugged and hidden under some filthy heap of rags in one of the huts, do you think? And why hide him at all, and then let him go? He returned the very day they left. At the volley of questions, Wharton shook his head. I can't even guess about that. He was certainly among the gypsies, but as for his delusions, to call them so, there is a kind of beauty and coherence about them which I don't like. The doctor eyed him sharply. You can't mean that you, doctor, said Wharton softly, do you recall what he wrote of the silversmiths and their work? They were making an elf trap. Well, I think the elf trap caught him. What?
Locke's tired eyes opened wide. A look of alarm flashed into them. The alarm was for Wharton, not himself.
"Wait," said the latter. "I haven't finished. You know that I was in the classroom at the moment when Professor Tatimus died."
"Yes?"
"Yes. I was the first to reach him, but before that I stood near the desk. There are three windows at the foot of that room. Every other man there faced the desk. I faced the windows."
The professor entered, laid down his book, and turned to the class. As he did so, a head appeared in one of those windows. They are close to the ground, and a person standing outside could easily look in. The head was a woman's. No, I am not inventing this. I saw her head draped in a blue scarf. I noticed because the scarf's blueness gave me the strangest thrill of delight. It was the exact blue of the sky behind it. Then she had raised her hand. I saw it. In her fingers was a spray of yellow flowers, yellow as sunshine. She waved them in a beckoning motion. Like this. Then Tatimus dropped. And there are legends, you know, of strange people, either more or less than human, who appear as gypsies, but are not real gypsies. They possess queer powers. Their outer appearance is rough and vile, but behind that, as a veil, they live a wonderful, hidden life of their own. And a man who has been with them once is caught in the real elf trap which the smith's work only symbolized. He may escape, but he can't forget nor be joined again with his own race, while to return among them he must walk the dark road that Tatimus had taken when she called. Oh, I've scoffed at old wives' tales with the rest of our overeducated modern kind. I can't ever scoff again, you see, because... What's that? A prescription? For me? Why, doctor, you don't yet understand. I saw her, I tell you, Elva. Elva. Elva of the wild honeysuckle and the sky-like scarf.
That was Elf Trap by Francis Stevens, narrated by Josh Roseman. The supernatural intruding into the mundane world is a theme I've always found interesting. As in our previous stories, The Sea Witch in episode 62, or The Hounds of Tyndalos in episode 34, this story shows us regular people struggling to decide whether a seemingly supernatural occurrence is real or could simply be written off as the product of a troubled mind. My favourite take on this concept would have to be in Neil Gaiman's Sandman series, during the story arc known as The Kindly Ones, where the protagonist Hippolyta Hall is either descending into madness while living on the streets, or she is a warrior going on a mystical quest for vengeance. The butterfly dreaming it's a man slash man dreaming he's a butterfly symmetry is played beautifully, and I highly recommend this particular arc and the rest of the Sandman series. We'd love to hear your thoughts on our protagonist's strange journey. Leave a comment on our site at protectingprojectpulp.com or join the conversation in the District of Wonders forum, linked from the site menu. And while you're there, don't forget to subscribe to the show via iTunes or your podcast app of choice. Just click the subscribe link. Thanks for listening from everyone here at PPP. Our assistant editor, Fred Heimbaugh, our sound engineer, Tom O'Dwyer, our producer, Tony C. Smith, and from me, your host, Simon Hildebrandt. We hope you'll join us next time for episode 84, where we'll bring you Child of Atlantis by Edmund Hamilton. Tread cautiously amongst gypsies, and have a great week.
This presentation has been brought to you by the District of Wonders Network, dedicated to podcasting the finest genre fiction. You can learn more about the District of Wonders and their many literary productions at their website, www.districtofwonders.com. Thank you for listening.